This is a recording of the open meeting of the Federal Election Commission held on December 17th, 2015. Should you have questions after listening to the recording, please call the FEC at 1-800-424-9530 or email us at info@fec.gov.
All right, so the next item is item number 6, rulemaking priorities and proposals. And while you were out of the room, Commissioner Hunter, we sort of went through all of these and have kind of figured out sort of a way forward on them. The first two items, Commissioner Goodman's items, will be subsumed in the discussion and motion that Commissioner Weintraub wishes to make with regard to the coordination rulemaking proposal that she and I proposed. So
you're going to start with that?
Do you want to go?
Well, I think there's a motion on the table, and I will just point out, because much has been made earlier today about how we should not.
Excuse me. Madam Secretary, was there a motion on the table, or does Commissioner Weintraub need to make the motion anew? I just don't recall.
I now have my notes. That's what I was going back and checking. And we are on agenda documents number 1554A and 1554A1, correct? That is what we are currently discussing?
I believe we're 1554D.
D.
The motion that Commissioner Weintraub had was to direct OGC to do a notice of proposed rulemaking with respect to agenda documents 1554A, 1554A1, and 1554D. The discussion continued, and bear with me. Subsequently, Commissioner Weintraub withdrew her motion and asked that it be held over to the next meeting.
We can dispense with that formality, then.
You want to renew your motion?
Yes, I do. I do wish to renew my motion. And for those who are listening in cyberspace and have no idea what 1554D and A are all about, Commissioner Goodman had some proposals for regulatory attention to political parties, and the chair and I had a proposal, again, relating to coordination, particularly with respect to what we term closely associated organizations, outside groups that appear to be functioning very closely with candidate committees. My motion was to couple these two proposals. I will note that much has been made earlier today about how we should not be doing rulemakings when Congress is considering the same topics. Congress is and has been actively considering any number of proposals on the regulation of political parties, but that doesn't seem to stop you in this instance from wanting to do something here, and I'm okay with that. I'm okay with our going forward and trying to provide some relief to political parties. I'm not sure about any of the particular proposals that you've come up with, whether they would withstand scrutiny under the Shays precedents, or I'm agnostic at this point as to whether I think they are these particular proposals are necessarily good ideas, but I'm happy to put them out there for public comment. I believe that the every article that I've seen that talks about the role of political parties having been diminished always couples that with a discussion of because of the enhanced role of the super PAC. So I think it really are, as I said before, they're two sides of the same coin. We should consider these issues together. And this is my effort to accommodate a rulemaking agenda that is near and dear to your heart, I know. This isn't my issue. This is your issue, the party issue. But we also have an issue that's near and dear to our hearts that we think is very closely related to that. So in the spirit of trying to find a path forward, I thought maybe we could do it all together. And I hope that you will consider voting for it.
Was that the motion made?
So I renew my motion that we direct the Office of General Counsel to prepare a rulemaking document that would cover the issues set forth in agenda documents 15-54A, what is it, AA1 and D.
Madam Chair, speak to the motion.
Yes, please.
I appreciate that you don't oppose giving some relief to the political parties. And yet, I find some provisions in what you're marrying up with this new rebuttable presumption of coordination, to be highly problematic. And fundamentally, the more I've studied it, that here's my fundamental concern with creating a rebuttable presumption, particularly in the case of family members. And that is that what this proposed rule would do is discriminate against people in the exercise of their First Amendment rights based on their status as a family member to somebody else. Now, familial relationships is a protected liberty interest under the 14th Amendment. And in addition to that, we have the overlay of a fundamental constitutional right under the First Amendment, because here people would be exercising First Amendment rights, and we are going to discriminate against them by creating a rebuttable presumption that we do not create or assume in the case of any other person. So I think that is fundamentally problematic. Now, when I looked at the history of this issue, I saw that the Commission has, by majority vote, this would reverse a decision of the Commission that family status does not create this rebuttable presumption. And that was a decision just 2 years ago in the case of J. Chen for Congress, MER 6668, where in the factual and legal analysis approved by the Commission said, the complaint points out that J. and Shaw Chen, this was an independent expenditure-only committee, with a brother who made independent expenditures and participated in them. And the commission said in its FLA, the complaint points out that Jay and Shaw Chen are siblings, but the commission has never determined that a familial relationship standing alone is sufficient to find reason to believe that coordination took place. In the present matter, the complaint does not allege, and there is no information evidencing any discussion, participation, or other activity between the Chen brothers that might satisfy the conduct prong. So we would be reversing something that we decided about just 2 years ago. Now, that's not to say that the Commission couldn't reverse its prior position, but let me talk about some of the reasons why. While I'm on that subject, that has been historically the position of the Commission as well in analogous contexts. So, for example, in Advisory Opinion 2003-10, Senator Reid and his son, Rory Reid, came to the Commission and wanted to know if Rory Reid could raise unlimited funds under Nevada law without being a per se agent of Senator Reid for purposes of requesting what was soft money under the Bipartisan Campaign Reform Act. And in that advisory opinion, the Commission rejected a per se rule based on familial status. It says it is not enough that there is some relationship or contact between the principal and this agent. Thus, the father-son relationship alone is insufficient to create an agency relationship. Not a coordination case, but a per se rule based on familial relationships. We would be reversing that rule by analogy. So now let's talk about how the rebuttable presumption would operate to chill what could be wholly permissible and compliant speech. So in the Federal Election Campaign Act regulates core First Amendment rights. All political activity is permitted unless it is expressly prohibited, right? Because we're operating in an area permeated by the First Amendment, and we can restrict it, but we're not here to permit it. So the Act and regulations prohibit only specific conduct for a compelling governmental interest implicated by that conduct. Now, the FECA also sets up, if you are going to be accused and held accountable for violating, for engaging in prohibited conduct, there must be a complaint. And either the complainant and or the commission bears the burden under the Act of affirmatively showing that someone has engaged in conduct that is prohibited. At the commission level, we have to make an affirmative finding of reason to believe. But now we would be using a presumption of guilt and removing that burden of proof at the first instance. So your free exercise of a constitutional right is restricted under a rebuttable presumption paradigm unless you can bear the burden of proving you have not broken the law. We've completely shifted that burden under the rebuttable presumption paradigm of this proposal. Now, even under the best of circumstances, it is incredibly difficult to prove a negative under a shifted burden. And it's not merely a theoretical concern that I'm expressing, because the case in point is the case you mentioned in our prior debate, MER 6611. It was Laura Ruderman, the case of Laura Ruderman. And in the case of Laura Ruderman, a mother established a super PAC to support her daughter. And when a complaint was filed that the mother and the daughter, based on their relationship, must have coordinated, there were submitted to the commission five or six unique affidavits from individuals involved in the process, expressly denying the conduct prongs of the coordination rule. And the first general counsel's report once again reiterated the rule. The commission has not found that a family relationship by itself is enough to provide reason to believe that there has been unlawful coordination. But then the first general counsel's report went through in specific detail the sworn testimony of five or six people involved in that instance. Very specific statements about the absence of coordination. Sworn declarations submitted to this commission, and yet three commissioners did not agree with the Office of General Counsel's analysis and would not credit the sworn testimony before the commission. And so what does this mean? It means that under the rebuttable presumption that would be established in this proposal before, people cannot sustain, they will always be, even if they come in with affidavits, five, six different people all testifying to their innocence, guess what they're going to be subjected to? A reasonably finding. In other words, it's not going to be good enough. They're going to be subjected to an investigation, and the costs inherent with having to affirmatively prove their case in an investigation, and reasonable people will therefore refrain from engaging in wholly permissible and legal First Amendment activity to avoid this heavy and expensive burden of proving their innocence under the Ruderman test. So I can't support putting that burden on people based solely on the basis that they are a family member. I might also add that this proposal reverses Advisory Opinion 2011-12. That was a vote of 6-0 to the Senate Majority PAC, and several commissioners here voted for that. And it reverses votes that we took a month ago on this commission after a virtual whole day meeting with Mr. Elias in the Senate Majority PAC. We just voted on two of these principles, and this would reverse a majority position that is probably less than a month old in that matter. So for all those reasons, yes, I support helping the political parties. I haven't heard real substantive objection to helping the political parties, but those are my substantive objections to creating a rebuttable presumption based on people merely because they have a familial relationship with another person. Thank you.
Thank you.
Commissioner Walter.
I think the reason that, first of all, I'll support the motion to move forward in the manner suggested by Commissioner Weintraub. But if we decide before we even vote that we're not going to agree to a particular one, it doesn't mean, I think, that we shouldn't offer more conversation in the public from people who may or may not be subject to it. Because as you can see from the most recent example, here we are, we have two or three AOs, advisory opinions, two or three areas of enforcement. We're all wiggling around this issue. If we took the time to have a rule, people in the street, except for the Marcolasses in the world, who would know about all of the AOs and the enforcement rules, would have some reasonable guidance on what father, son, mother, daughter, mother, son, father, daughter now could do. And I think that's really important to have it, to be able to read it in a reg that, this is a consideration under the following circumstances or something along that line, so that we're actually using the rules to provide guidance to people on the street. And maybe there's some contours out there that we haven't talked about because they only come up to us in a certain factual context, and we never really get a chance to sit back and say, okay, we could really do it this way. And somebody a lot smarter than us might have a way where we can decide some of these things in a context that we can agree on. So that's the reason I think in a rulemaking we shouldn't automatically reject something that we're opposed to at the outset, as long as it might, if dialogue took place, might help establish some basic ground rules that we could move forward with.
Okay. Oh, Commissioner Hunter.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think Commissioner Walther and other comments have brought to fore a substantive, different way of looking at rulemakings here. I agree with you that in the context of the AOs we talked about this morning, those kinds of things might be appropriate to have a public hearing or a rulemaking or on certain issues. On certain issues, I agree with you. But on this one, I believe that if we put this document out, the one proposed by Commissioner Weintraub and the chair, yes, we'd get public comments, but there's almost no way that I could support doing some of these things, even if the vast majority of public comments were in favor of, let's just say, adopting number two. And we can talk a little bit more in detail about provision number two. And so it's to me just a complete waste of the public's time to put out a proposal that is certain to not garner support by at least half of the commission. I mean, we just think that it's fundamentally unconstitutional, and I don't know that anybody's comments would change that. There are tons of areas of our regulations that don't implicate the First Amendment in the same way that this does. There really are a few. I know you're shocked to hear that, but there are some. With respect to number two in the proposal, it converts issue speech to political speech, in my view, and I'll tell you why. I read the provision here. Communications that are created, produced, or distributed based on information about the candidates or committee's campaign needs or plans that the candidate or committee provided to the expending person or entity, directly or indirectly, such as information concerning campaign messaging, planned expenditures, or polling data. You could imagine a situation whereby an organization like, let's just say, AARP or the NRA, went and met with a member of Congress, and the member of Congress said, the Second Amendment is going to be a huge issue in my campaign. And then the NRA goes out and runs an independent expenditure on that, 6 months later, just because he says, or if he even doesn't say in my campaign, he just says that the Second Amendment is a big issue to me. Then somebody goes out and runs an independent expenditure talking about how so-and-so is a great person because he supports the Second Amendment. One could read this provision to say that person got the information about the campaign directly, and it affects the messaging of the campaign. Or if the person just listened to a speech, didn't even go in and meet with the member of Congress, which that should be completely protected by the Constitution. And they just hear a member talking about the importance of the Second Amendment at a public forum or even on the news, and then went later and took that information to say, I'm going to run an independent expenditure talking about this issue. You could see how that person may violate this provision that's being proposed. And so I really just don't see a way forward for that kind of proposal. Again, regardless of what kind of comments come out, it's really flies in the face of the Constitution and would convert issue speech to political speech. And it's not something that I would be able to support.
Commissioner Weintraub.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate my colleague's comments. As Commissioner Goodman knows, after the last meeting, I said, if you have questions, if you have thoughts about this, you know, my door is always open. Please come talk to me, as seems to be the case more often than not around here. You decided to save it all up for the public meeting. I do recall the cases that you talked about. It would have been nice to have known that those were your particular concerns. I would have reread them so they would be very fresh in my mind, but that's okay. The way that the Commission used to do rulemakings, when it was able to do rulemakings, when we used to do half a dozen rulemakings a year, in addition to staying on top of our enforcement docket, yes, this actually happened, was that we had a general agreement on both sides of the aisle that people could put their thoughts, their proposals, their questions into the rulemaking document. And as I said before, this is our proposal. We've got another one. We're happy to include that as well. The real problem is that you are fundamentally not interested in doing any kind of rulemaking that would address super PACs. Every time we try and suggest it, you don't say, well, no, we don't want to do it this way, we want to do it that way. You say, just no. Now, back in Buckley, one of your favorite cases, the court said that contribution limits to candidates are constitutional. They are consistent with the First Amendment because when a candidate accepts unlimited contributions, it creates an inherent risk of corruption. That's what the court said. It's constitutional to have contribution limits for candidates. And what the court has said is independent spending, spending that is truly independent of the candidate, doesn't pose that risk because the candidate doesn't have that same kind of control. And what has evolved is a system where super PACs now, which didn't exist back in the Buckley era, super PACs now exist that function for the sole benefit of advancing an individual candidate. And some of these super PACs are indeed set up with the cooperation of the candidate, with the active participation of close associates of the candidate himself sometimes, the candidate's immediate family, the candidate's close advisors, people who advised the candidate in a previous election cycle. And the candidate goes out and raises money for them and tells people, you know, go ahead and give money in either directly or signals that is their super PAC. They're referred to publicly as the candidate's super PAC with an ownership interest almost. And we have this bizarre situation out there where it is illegal for the candidate, him or herself, to accept into their own campaign committee a $3,000 contribution, but it is perfectly legal for a super PAC that does absolutely nothing other than promote that candidate with the advice and counsel of people who are closely associated with that candidate to collect unlimited contributions, millions of dollars in contributions from individual donors. Some of these super PACs we've seen some super PACs that were almost solely supported by one individual who was very committed to the candidate and spent millions and millions of dollars on that candidate's behalf. And again, what this proposal would do would be to acknowledge the reality of that and to take into account the Supreme Court guidance that these independent groups have to be truly independent, otherwise they will pose the very same risk of corruption. And that's what we're trying to prevent. Now, we modeled this proposal, which, by the way, is not limited to, doesn't really talk all about family members. That's just one aspect of it. We modeled this on some ideas that Richard Befault has articulated in a law review article that he's submitted to the commission. We've all had access to it, and to the recently adopted rules. We also looked at the recently adopted rules of the California Fair Political Practices Commission, and that's where we got this notion of the rebuttable presumption. And in my notion of the rebuttable presumption was that it was a way of saying these aren't automatic disqualifiers. I mean, I had seen earlier versions of proposals suggested, and I have contemplated other versions of proposals that would just say, if you meet this, and this criteria, then it's a done deal. We're automatically going to find that is coordinated. But we moved to the rebuttable presumption because we wanted to provide an opportunity for people to come in and say, no, that's not true in this case. Now, if you don't like rebuttable presumption, we could talk about factors instead of rebuttable presumptions. I think this could be reworked if it's the rebuttable presumption that you're all hung up on. But for the benefit of people who are listening and don't have this scintillating blue document in front of them, that what the proposal suggests is that it's not just the single factor of a family relationship, contrary to what Commissioner Goodman was suggesting before, that automatically puts someone at legal risk. First, you've got to have an organization that is whose election-related spending is the majority of it. Let me start over. An organization which is spending the majority of its election-related spending for the benefit of a single candidate. And in addition to that, the organization either, there's a number of factors here that could come into play, has an employee, independent contractor, or founder who is, the candidate's immediate family member, or who previously was employed by or worked as an independent contractor for the candidate or a committee authorized by the candidate in the past year. Or maybe none of those things are true. Or this election, single candidate super PAC, I'll use the shorthand, has received fundraising support from the candidate's campaign, the candidate's immediate family member or staff in the past year. Or it shares a common vendor with the candidate, and the common vendor provided any of the services listed at Regulation 11 CFR 109.21D42, which is part of our existing coordination regulation, or has been publicly identified by the candidate as a vehicle for supporting that very same candidate. The candidate's out there saying, hey, you want to support me? Go give money to this super PAC. So that there are, it's not just hinged on the rights of family members or the existence of family members, although I think for most people out there, they wouldn't find it terribly surprising that we would look at that we would look at relationships with candidates when we're trying to figure out whether the super PAC that is doing nothing but supporting that candidate, or at least is spending a majority of its spending supporting that candidate, when we look at whether that group is truly independent of the candidate. I think a lot of people out there would not find it counterintuitive to say, well, let's look at some of these relationships and let's factor that into the test of what is truly independent, a test that has been endorsed by the Supreme Court and is in no way unconstitutional. So this was a slightly revised version of an idea that we've been kicking around for a while. You don't like this one, we're happy to engage with you on modifying this. But as I said, I think the real problem is, and this is really a continuation of the earlier discussion, that you're just, no matter how many people out there write in and say, we think this is a big problem, the relationship between candidates and super PACs and whether they're really functioning in an independent way, no matter what people say, you are just unwilling to regulate super PACs in any way. You're unwilling to look at our coordination regulations and see whether they still make any sense at all in a world of single candidate super PACs that are out there doing all the advertising. As I said, the single candidate super PACs are taking on more and more of the functions of what used to be run out of the campaign itself, which only makes the candidates more and more indebted to the folks who are running the super PACs and the folks who are supporting the super PACs. And I think there is a real risk of corruption there, the kind of corruption that the Supreme Court has specifically acknowledged is a factor that the commission can consider and in crafting rules. So that's my pitch. I don't expect that I'm going to convince anyone. I voted against the Ruderman case, and I don't think this in any way contradicts precedents that say if the only thing that you've got is the fact that there's a family member, then that's not going to be enough to trigger an investigation, and indeed it wouldn't be under this proposal either.
Any other comments?
I'll defer to Commissioner
Wong. I'm just going to remind Commissioner Hunter, you know, sometimes I change my mind.
Yeah, this doesn't happen that often.
By the time she gets done grinding on me, sometimes I actually realize that, you're making some sense there. I can go along with that. So I just want to tell you that it can happen. Yeah.
Commissioner Goodman.
Well, point taken.
Madam Chair, this is your proposal. So I just have a few technical questions. Under the definition of election-related spending, there are three categories given in this proposal. One is spending of funds for the purpose of influencing a federal election. And number three is expenditures reported as independent expenditures. So I guess one question I have is, what's the difference between an expenditure to influence a federal election, which historically has been given the definition of express advocacy, and three, expenditures reported as independent expenditures, which are express advocacy expenditures? What was the thought behind capturing something different?
Well, we also have two electioneering
communications. I'm not questioning those because I know what those are.
And so
my question is, what's the distinction between one and three?
It's just a catch-all, I would say, to ensure that it's understood that it will be all of these three together, one and
a catch-all. It's broader than electioneering communications and independent expenditures.
No, it's expenditures that are reported as independent expenditures together with all those other spending to influence a federal election, including and electioneering. That's all. It's not, and you know, if you're not satisfied with those definitions, as my colleague has indicated, we can discuss them.
Well, then why delineate a separate provision from electioneering communications and independent expenditures? Why delineate another provision called influencing the federal
election? Well, we can talk.
And then enhancing it further by saying any candidate research and polling.
Well, it doesn't say any candidate research and polling.
Including candidate research and polling.
Including candidate research and polling.
Well, let me ask you, if I make no communication, but I've performed polling to inform my organization about the candidates, I've run some head-to-heads.
Right.
That kind of expenditure now becomes the subject of a coordination?
Is it provided to the candidate?
If.
That would be an in-kind contribution. That's different. Or are you taking in-kinds and putting them in here? I'm trying to understand why we have this separate provision in addition to independent expenditures.
To the extent that candidate research and polling would go behind the independent expenditures and electioneering communications, they would be captured there. So it wouldn't just be the expense of broadcasting.
So it's not a standalone provision influencing a federal election. It is expenditures that that underlie the independent expenditure that go into the actual communication by.
I think it could certainly be interpreted that way, and I would be happy to engage with you in the nuances of what that means in the context of the rulemaking, or even in the context of drafting the notice of proposed rulemaking.
Exactly. You're asking to open this door. I'm trying to see what door we're opening. I have another question down below.
We're just asking for it to be drafted. We're not suggesting that this is the final product.
Well, before I open the door on the drafting, I have a right to understand what I'm voting on. I'm just asking some technical questions about...
Course.
About the proposal that you all drafted and placed on the public agenda.
Right.
Go ahead.
I got a question about whether or not the sharing of information is direct or indirect. That's down below on page 2. Would public domain, is it contemplated in this proposal that sharing information through the public domain, either through the press statements about what our strategy is or posting information on the World Wide Web, Is that considered an indirect sharing of information, or is it contemplated that that's what we mean by direct or indirect, or do we contemplate something more specific than placing strategy and needs and desires in the public domain?
In my view, I think that's something that we should put out for comment and discuss with people as to whether it should be a narrower or a broader concept, whether we want to try and capture people announcing publicly, hey, it sure would be great if somebody would run some ads talking about my record on the Second Amendment in the northeast quadrant of the state. Boy, that would be helpful. I mean, that's a public statement.
People do that now. People say, I'm having trouble in New Hampshire, or I'm having trouble, or I need extra help in South Carolina. Some people say, I'm not going to compete in Iowa. I'm going to put all my eggs into New Hampshire. They say that publicly. Is that under this? Would that be indirect sharing of needs? Is that the wink and a nod that we would treat as coordinated expenditure if a group decided to not spend any money after that, hearing that in the public airwaves? If an independent expenditure only committee decided at that point, I'm not going to spend any money in Iowa, we're going to spend all of our money discussing this race in New Hampshire, would that type of public statement then become a form of indirect sharing and coordination?
That's a question that I would like to pose in the notice of proposed rulemaking and get public comment on.
I don't know that I need public comment to decide that issue and where I come down on that issue.
Well, you probably don't need public comment to decide how you're going to vote on this issue in any sense.
What I'm hearing is that there are many unanswered
Well, there are.
Here.
There okay. are.
What happens
That's
at the beginning
point.
Of a notice of proposed
That is
rulemaking.
The point of it.
This isn't the end point. It's the beginning.
Well, let me just say that I also, on page 3, under numbers 5 and 6 on page 3, this follows up on Commissioner Hunter's concerns that she expressed. It speaks in terms of an advertisement that someone has participated in, suggesting at any time historically, without any content restriction at all. And that in number 6, the promote, support, attack, or oppose language appears, do you have a clear understanding of what support or oppose somebody means? Because that's the PASO standard, and it vexes a lot of people. And so it looks like we are going to expand the realm into issue speech. This was Commissioner Hunter's point. Do you have an answer to that concern, that we are not expanding, we are not proposing to expand the subject of coordination beyond independent expenditures and electioneering communications to issue speech?
Well, if issue speech, depending on what kind of issue speech it is, if it is coordinated, if a candidate, for example, requested it, mm-hmm. then it might well be brought in, but again, that's something that I would want to explore in the rulemaking context. We had some discussion about this probably 10 years ago in a rulemaking here, but I think a lot has changed in the last 10 years, and I think we could have a very informative set of public comments and hearing on this. And I just want to be clear about the participated in the recording of an advertisement, because you left out the second part of that, which is created or paid for by an independent expenditure-only political committee. So you've got a super PAC out there that is doing nothing but advancing the interests of a particular candidate and trying to get that candidate elected, and the candidate appears in their advertising, shows up, and allows themselves to be filmed by that super PAC for the purpose of their running an ad on that candidate's behalf. Do I think that would indicate a degree of coordination? Well, yeah, I do, actually.
Well, the way it's worded is have participated, meaning in the past, and an advertisement. What if the advertisement discusses the need for a March of Dimes or, a charitable message?
I would be happy to. I'd be happy to amend that to make sure that wouldn't that wouldn't be captured by this. I think that's a fair comment, and I think that is exactly what one does in the process of writing a rule. You put out a proposal, you get comments, you exchange feedback with your colleagues, and you try and come up with a better rule. But yes, if somebody shows up in a studio that is paid for by a single candidate super PAC that is set up only to advance the interests of that particular individual. And let's say the individual hasn't declared his or her candidacy yet, but then they declare his or their candidacy a day after they do the filming, and the super PAC runs the ad. Do I think that ought to be captured? Yeah, I do.
Commissioner Hunter.
I don't think we're going to resolve this today.
I'm so disappointed.
But I just want to say that as I said earlier, there are many proposals here that I wouldn't be willing to vote for, even with public comment, because we think they're unconstitutional, suppress issue speech, all the things that we like to talk about. But I do want to say I appreciate the fact that this is at least a proposal with some particularity, unlike the one that we voted on a little while ago, where it just was sort of an amorphous, idea sort of cribbed from the New York Times. This one at least has some particularity, so I do at least appreciate that.
Well, let me just say that I have been talking about the issues in that first proposal for years now, so it's not something that's been cribbed from the New York
Times.
Maybe
they cribbed it from you.
Maybe. A lot of people are talking about these issues. I think that's part of our point.
Right. I think the frustration here is, and we'll go back to the fact that there's two actual parts to this motion, and that includes your party request that you've been, talking about over a year, and how it is, as Commissioner Weintraub said, based, and I've not only heard it from you, but I've heard it from many others, that it's based on the fact that there are independent expenditures and super PACs that are getting unlimited amounts of money and therefore are weakening the parties and the important role that parties play in our democratic system. I don't know. There's still, social scientists who disagree with that, but viscerally, I agree. I'm concerned about that problem, for sure. But it seems to me very odd that none of the proponents of permitting much greater loosening of rules with respect to the parties are also interested in doing something about the problems of both disclosure and coordination relating to super PACs and independent expenditures. And it is it leads me to believe that perhaps that argument is a straw argument, and that really what we're hoping for here, and you can tell me if I'm wrong, is a complete loosening of campaign finance rules that are meant to protect the public from corruption in the system. It's just anomalous to me that those of you who are constantly having this refrain would be more concerned about having some way of looking at the impact of super PACs rather than going the other way, which is, okay, it's free for all for everybody. I mean, that's the problem here. What we're asking for, if you don't like specifics of it, if you raise issues that are problematic, if council raises issues that are problematic, we certainly are open to making changes there. But I don't see any willingness to even consider these issues, and that is causing concern, I think, to me and to many others in the public. So given that, all those in favor?
On the table.
Motion on the table. All those in favor of the motion. You have the motion, Madam Secretary.
Yes, I do.
Thank you. All those in favor, please indicate by saying aye.
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 Aye. All those opposed?
No.
No.
Okay, Madam Secretary, that motion fails. Commissioner Weintraub, Walther, and myself voting yes, and Commissioner Goodman, Hunter, and Vice Chair Peterson voting no. Okay. The next, I know, right.